From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 390 for this March 25th, 2012. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. Now, last week, for those of you that were listening in last week, I was talking about essentially truth in advertising. That is, if someone is making a claim and offering you a treatment, do you want to know, first of all, how they came about, understanding the mechanism behind how this particular treatment helps you, and whether it indeed has the evidence to support what they are saying? Well, to take that a little further, yesterday on page A7 of the National Post is an article by a really well-respected journalist, science journalist, Tom Blackwell. And it's entitled, It's So Lax. Health Canada has loosened its oversight of natural remedies so much so that critics claim it's failing to protect the public. So in this case, he's dealing with a couple of companies, and he focuses on them providing the evidence to date and what Health Canada has done. And one of them was a company that 8 years ago, Health Canada took a step prosecuting it for allegedly making unjustified claims about its products, including a hot seller called Heart Drops. And this is the Strauss Herb Company. And the Heart Drops, which they claimed clears clogged arteries, restores poor circulation, shrinks enlarged hearts, was eventually given a license by Health Canada under its 8-year-old natural health product system. And the reason they did this is because Strauss changed its claims to become a little less detailed. Another company called Nutritional Support Limited, True Hope Nutritional Support Limited in Alberta, they have something called Empower Plus, which is a vitamin combination, it says, that can treat bipolar disorder and psychiatric disease. It too has Health Canada approval, despite federal prosecution of True Hope in 2004 over claims for the medicine and later warnings to the public about Empower's potential dangers. So now that these two things have been approved, and Dr. Lloyd Opel of the BC Medical Association said that we're witnessing the collapse of scientific standards that we've come to rely on. He says that Health Canada is a sick mechanism, sick in the sense that they are not functioning. The Canadian Medical Association as well mentioned, Canadian Medical Association Journal delivered a pretty much a scathing rebuke of the system, decrying the specious double standard applied to natural medicines versus pharmaceutical ones. So if we get down further in, here's some of the arguments that have been presented, right? So one was by the president of the Canadian Health Food Association saying natural remedies simply have to be viewed as a unique class, said Helen Sherard, quote, they are low-risk products by nature and should be regulated as such. Well, as far as I know, there are a lot of things that you can consume in nature that are harmful for you. So that argument really doesn't really wash too well. You have to remember that the way things are investigated is that you will start off with a particular chemical compound, and you do laboratory and then animal testing, then randomized controlled trials on people where you establish product safety and effectiveness compared to placebo and other medicines. And the rate is usually about 4 out of 10 of these particular potential medicines fail along that line or on the final test and never make it onto market. Well, with regards to the Heart Drops, as this goes on, they claim, and this is one of the owners of the of Strauss, Mr. Kettle, says that points to thousands of testimonials from patients who report that their heart problems were dramatically improved by the herbal cocktail. One of two actual studies that were cited on Strauss's website followed 16, that is 16, 16 patients over a year, concluding their blood cholesterol levels were lowered 29%, but it wasn't a blinded study. Patients knew they were taking the substance, and there was no control group taking a placebo, so you couldn't even compare it to not taking the drops, and the subjects could keep consuming whatever medications they were taking in the first place. And another 2005 study that they that was blinded, with about 20 angina patients assigned to each two groups, one getting the heart drops and the other a placebo, found no difference in the blood pressure and cholesterol levels, though a number of symptoms reported by the heart drops group fell faster than those among the placebo subjects. There is one study that looked at the particular substance, and that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. It found that statin medications, which are used to lower cholesterol, it also lowered cholesterol-related hearing loss and clogged arteries in mice that were genetically altered to develop atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries. Mice taking the heart drops, on the other hand, developed significant hearing loss and severe atherosclerosis. So again, the point is that just because something may be natural, right, and the claim, and this is from a Dr. Sunita Vohra, a pediatrician at the University of Alberta, who claims that a natural substance that has been around for thousands of years, used by millions of people, is more likely to be safe than a brand new pharmaceutical drug tested in a couple of trials. As a measure of safety, quote, as a measure of safety, I don't actually know that the randomized control trial is the be-all and end-all. Well, frankly, if you're going to state that just because you've been using something for thousands of years, it's somehow safe, that doesn't wash either. You don't have the evidence for that. You just have anecdotal reporting. And you don't know how much somebody has taken, what side effects you've had, because you haven't monitored anybody. And so when we get back from after the news, and I encourage you to I encourage you to take a look at this article. I just sort of briefly went over it. Again, it's on page A7 of Saturday's National Post by Tom Blackwell, called "It's So Lax." I want to go over what you can do. That is what I tend to do when I look at these articles, look at these claims. But the questions that you can ask, and I've also put these on my website that will be posted after the show at drbarrydworkin.com, where you can actually get a toolkit, what you need to do in order to ask questions to your satisfaction, and that they that have to be answered before we accept claims that are being made, and instead of having an argument over what we believe works, we should actually have an argument over what we observe and are able to verify actually works. So I'm going to get into the baloney detection kit and as well take your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. All our lines are available. Don't want to talk to myself for the rest of the afternoon. Love to be able to speak with you. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Music is the doctor. Makes you feel like you want to. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number, and yes, indeed, all our lines are available. Looking forward to your calls. As I mentioned, I really don't want to be talking for the full hour to myself. I'd rather be talking with you. But I will get into the baloney detection kit. Now, this is derived from astronomer and science writer and researcher Carl Sagan. And again, it's 10 questions. And then there's more information regarding the background to those questions. But it is 10 questions that should be asked when someone is making a claim. And so the first question is, how reliable is the source of the claim? And when someone is making, and especially when you deal with pseudoscience, that is people that are making these claims about just extraordinary results with what they're proposing, often they appear quite reliable. But when you examine them closely, the facts and figures that they tend to use are either distorted, they take them out of context, they cherry pick information, or even fabricate some of the information. In other words, making it up. So that's one of the questions to ask is, okay, is what is being claimed reliable? What is the source for that? Does this source make often similar claims? That is, do they go beyond the facts? Do they then just sort of take this and run with it? And do they make other claims for other products that they produce, also sounding wonderful, but do they have the evidence to back it up? And again, with regards to the evidence, and the third question is, have the claims been verified by another source? So are we depending upon the proprietor or the manufacturer to present the information and say that it's working? And obviously they have a vested interest in making sure that that's the case. Have they been verified, right? So in other words, who's checking the claims and who is checking the checkers? Do they have a peer review system? Do they have a means of being able to establish whether something is being presented is actually correct? And importantly, how does that claim fit with how the world works, or how we know, or are to the best of our ability, how we know how things work? And so if there's an extraordinary claim being made, you know, this cures cancer, this cures a particular type of cancer, okay, show me how they did this. Show me the mechanism of why this works, right? Does it fit into the established understanding of how cancer presents itself, the genetics behind it, the triggers for cancer, the lifestyle impact of that can lead to cancerous change? How does what you're proposing fit into the model that we generally accept and understand? And has anyone gotten, fifth question is, has anyone gone out of the way to disprove the claim, or has only supportive evidence been sought? So this is the typical testimonials that you'll hear. Well, they say thousands and thousands of people have said this works. Yeah, but what about the likely thousands of people for whom it did not work, but you don't report it because you don't have any means of gauging out of all the people what percentage it actually worked for? You're only going by testimonials. And most people, when they give testimonials, are happy with something. Those that aren't happy may complain, but you'll be pretty sure that the company will not post those on their site. So again, you have to have a means of preventing this kind of what we call confirmation bias. That is, looking for things, looking for evidence that only supports your view, and rejecting outright anything that tends to be contrary to your hypothesis. I'll get into the other five after the calls, but again, the first five are: how reliable is the source of the claim? Does this source often make similar claims? Have the claims been verified by another source? How does the claim fit with what we know about how the world works? And has anyone gone out of the way to disprove the claim, or has only supportive evidence been sought? I know this may seem a little dry, but it is so important because it protects you from being fooled. It protects you from spending money on areas that won't help you, taking money out of your pocket that could be applied to other aspects of your health. It also helps you become a better consumer and, frankly, a better scientist, a better way. You don't have to have a degree to be able to do this. You can do this just by asking the questions, sticking with a model of inquiry, and it is up to the other person to be that is making the claim to give you the answers. And if they don't make sense, then don't accept them. There's no reason why you have to accept something if something seems a little bit wonky. We're going to go to the phone lines, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And a good afternoon to Lorna in Ottawa.
Hello.
Hi.
Did you say Lorna?
Yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What I'd like to know is right at the back of my neck, just starts above my shoulder, goes up the back of my neck.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real sharp pain. It's a sore pain. Goes across the back of my neck and across up the right side of my head. And then as it goes up that side, I've had a few times that my vision has blurred,
mm-hmm.
but the pain then continues to go up to the top of your head, and it just feels like your whole head is burning. And the second time it happened, when I was just watching TV, everything just went like stars or all bright colored lights.
So when did this first start happening with this pain?
The first one was in February.
Okay, and then has this happened frequently, or has this been February and now one again recently?
I had one again on the 6th of March, and I did go to a doctor. One thought perhaps it might be a migraine,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't really sure. And then when I saw my own family doctor when he was back, he is ordering an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm just wondering is there anything you can do for the pain in the meantime? Like, I've tried Advil, but because I'm a cancer patient in remission for 4 years,
mm-hmm.
and the Advil, you know, really bothers my stomach, I guess, the
right.
pain. And I'm just a little concerned. Would that be something that would spread, or would it just be...
Okay, so the pain you said starts in your shoulders. It goes from...
Well, yes, it starts right at the top of my shoulder. It goes
yep.
up the left side of my neck, then
yep.
it crosses over,
mm-hmm.
and then just goes up around past my ear and that eye.
Okay.
And then even the bones right under my eye, or just above my eye, they're sore. And the whole head in their spots, there's about 4 spots in my head that you get really sore spots. But it scares me, the blurring,
mm-hmm.
and then you sort of feel nauseated.
How long does the pain last when it does occur?
It's not going away.
Oh, so it's there all the time?
Yeah, pretty well now.
So the one that you had in February, that did go away, but the one on March the 6th has remained with you?
Yeah, pretty well. Like, I was trying Advil, and I tried Aleve for the first one. They
mm-hmm.
suggested that. And then I tried amitriptyline, but I found after I'd taken 3 that I started to get nightmares. So
mm-hmm.
the doctor said I could stop if I wanted to, and I sort of did, but I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what I should be doing, and I don't know. How long does it take to get an MRI after? Did they put it in last Tuesday?
It may take quite some time, Lorna. It depends on which hospital they've sent it. Usually when we order MRIs, we try and frankly tend to avoid sending people to the Ottawa hospital because they tend to have the longest waiting
yeah.
list. The Queensway and the Montfort tend to have a quicker turnaround time, and frankly, sometimes even in Kingston, if someone has a means of getting to Kingston, it tends to be even faster getting MRIs that way. So,
because I thought he said perhaps the Civic, he said wherever the general place was that they all went.
Right. Well,
now
they're not all integrated, so the MRIs for the general are when you give a requisition in, do not apply to the Montfort or to the Queensway Carleton. They're separate requisitions that have to go to each of those hospitals.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so the Queensway, that's
right.
close.
So when you have pain, it's only on the left side.
That's what it is now. It comes up the left side of my neck, but it's really sore, like all day today. Like I just keep putting a cushion around it to
mm-hmm.
prop up my neck, or the heating pad. The heat helps a bit, and I just put
right.
the heat all over my head. But
because the path that you're describing, where it comes from the shoulder,
yeah.
up the side of the head, and then over the top, we have to think of not only all the structures in that area. That includes bone, muscle, nerve, blood flow, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Lorna, what I'd like to do is when we come back, because we have to take a break for the news, we're going to
okay.
go over each of those things, and I'm going to ask you some questions to try and help us determine what combination of factors may be contributing to your headache and perhaps some of the things we may be able to do until that MRI is done. But I just don't want to let you go and then, you know, not have a complete answer for you. So I'd like to wait just after the news. That way we'll have a bit more time to go over some of this with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, so I'm just going to put you on hold right now. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Lorna. We have Bernie in Ottawa as well, has some questions about breathing problems. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be right back after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor Sunday House Call at CFRA.com.
Five to one talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to return and continue our conversation with Lorna. And Lorna, when this happened in February with the pain on that side, your neck and the head, was there any injury? Was there anything that happened at that time? Any fall or slip or anything?
Actually, I did have a fall out on the ice, but I feel more on my hip than anything. But I found that for my shoulder, like when I turn my head, if you're driving at the time, my neck was really stiff to turn.
And that happened right after your fall?
Well, no, that happened a bit before. But then it has continued. Like, it just seems to get stiffer and stiffer. Now that part isn't so bad. I can turn it a bit. Mm-hmm. But, because I haven't been driving since this happened.
Right.
But
it still hurts when you still can't fully turn your head.
Not comfortably.
Okay.
No, because as soon as I turn it a little bit more to the left, then you immediately feel it. It's like in the muscle, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is the pain that originally started. Is that similar? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're describing, again, when we look at areas of the body where there's pain, you have to look at the anatomy. It's very important to know what's in that area that could potentially be causing that discomfort. So when you described, and very well, the pain that ran from the shoulder up to the neck, that muscle in that area that follows exactly that path is a muscle called the trapezius muscle. It's one of the largest muscles in our back. It's obviously on both sides. Runs from the back of the head, literally from sort of, if you go up the neck to touch the skull, just as it meets the skull, it attaches in that area, runs down to your shoulder, goes from the shoulder and runs all the way down, almost like a diamond shape, to the middle of your back.
Yep.
And when people fall or they suddenly turn their head or for whatever reason the muscle gets stretched too quickly, it tears. And when it tears, it spasms. And when it spasms, it's very painful, and the pain will run exactly as you've described, running all the way up to the back of the head, but it doesn't always stop there. And the reason why it doesn't stop there is that the tendon from this muscle, which attaches to the skull, pulls on the surface of the skull as well. And because the surface of the skull has a tissue on it called periosteum, which simply means tissue sitting on the top of the bone itself, that gets painful too. And pain will run up the side of the head and sometimes towards the front of the head as well.
Yeah, so it goes across, it sort of touched the bone just above my eyes.
Yeah, and that so you may have, you also may have several issues going on concurrently. So although there's pain in the back of the neck, you may also have something as well with the front of the head, because it doesn't usually go all the way to the front of the head. It usually will come up the side, sometimes stopping just at the level of your temple or so, but usually doesn't go towards the eye. So some of the suggestions I would have are, in order to determine exactly what's contributing to the pain, sometimes what we do is we do a local injection in the area of the muscle that hurts the most of just an anesthetic. There's nothing other than just stuff that we use to freeze the skin when you do minor surgery. In this case, you inject it just into the muscle, and that provides almost immediate relief if you get the right spot. And that way, it also helps determine, okay, what other areas are painful? Because if you alleviate a lot of that muscle pain, then the question becomes, well, are there other areas of the head now that aren't hurting as much as well? If there still are areas of the head that hurt after that muscle pain has been relieved, well, then we know that there's likely two separate things that are happening here. And so you should also have an eye exam to look at the eye, also to examine the sinuses around the eye on the top and on the bottom of the eye.
I saw an ophthalmologist.
Yeah.
And he said my eyes were okay, but he is sending me now to another person to check for cataracts.
Right. So there's still extra things that need to be done with regards to the eye. There's also an examination of the cranial nerves. That is the nerves that come out of the neck and the brain and that provide sensation and function to the face and the eyes and pretty much everything in our head. And there are specific, very straightforward clinical evaluations that are done. In other words, a physical exam that's done to assess each of these nerves to see if they are contributing to any of the difficulties that you're having. Because since we know where these nerves come out with regards to where they come from in the brain, mm-hmm. it also can help provide clues about whether there is something indeed happening inside the head that's contributing to the pain. Because if the cranial nerves are normal, that means that there's nothing really inside the head that's doing this to you with regards to the nerves themselves.
And so, how I get that test done?
Well, usually just your family doctor. It's a very straightforward, easy way to figure that out.
Okay.
The other is to also palpate the areas that are painful, finding if there are specific trigger points or specific areas in the neck or on the head that are painful. And again, mm-hmm. those can be treated from a diagnostic point of view to try and figure out what's going on by sometimes just applying a local anesthetic into the area.
And is that sort of like with cortisone, no?
Not with cortisone at first. You don't want to use cortisone yet. And mm-hmm. the reason is that you're just, this is a test. Using a little bit of anesthetic in an area that hurts the most, because you won't do someone harm by doing that, because the anesthetic lasts only about an hour, mm-hmm. hour and a half. But if it alleviates your pain, right? So say, for example, they give you the anesthetic in your neck and you go, wow, I can move my head almost all the way now. Or they find a small area on the skull that hurts a lot, mm-hmm. and they give you a small injection there with the anesthetic and you go, wow, the pain is gone. Well, I can tell you that the MRI is not going to tell us very much, because if you've eliminated pain by injecting on the surface, you now know that the pain is because of the muscle and tissues on the skull and not inside the skull. So this is how we try to figure things out, especially if the MRI is going to take time to get. This is one way to at least establish whether we're dealing with something on the surface or whether we're dealing with something that's inside of the head. And if by doing these tests, it shows, for example, hey, you know, there probably is something we have to check inside the head. Well, then your physician can call the hospital and with the requisition, say, you know, I want this looked at a little bit more quickly. It's more of an urgent thing. And here's why. We can't alleviate the pain by doing local injections on the surface. There's something up. Let's take a look inside. So it in some ways helps give you a direction about what to do to establish what's causing this pain. But you do have, from what you described, you certainly do have pain in the muscle of the neck that certainly has contributed to the difficulties with turning your head, and is very well known that it can cause pain that radiates up the side of the head. This condition is called torticollis, is the fancy term for it. And it is very common, but it can take some time for this to heal, and it also should be treated. It's not something that necessarily is going to go away on its own, especially if there are activities or things that you're doing during the day that's putting pressure or stress on that muscle.
Yeah, like I think, you know, when I did fall, I know I kept my eyes, gave my head a quick jerk up so my head wouldn't hit the ice.
Yeah, and that definitely can tear the muscle.
And that may have been part of it.
Yeah, and it's always important to find out what happened at the time when that pain occurred, because the history is so important at determining what the potential mechanism is mm-hmm. of the condition. And given that this happened around the time that you fell, people tend to tighten up as they're falling because they don't want to, you know, they're bracing themselves for the fall. And muscles tear. And especially in the neck, if you're falling back, your head weighs quite a bit. Your head weighs, you know, 20, 30 pounds. It weighs quite a bit. And so the momentum of your head when you're falling, your muscles contracting to try and prevent your head from whipping back, is going to cause some tears.
Okay, so then these sore spots up on the top, it's just like right on the hard spot on the left side, on the top of my head, over my left eye and over my right eye, there's another, those two spots, that would be something the same then.
That would be, although what I would do is I would stay away from the areas of the eyes. I wouldn't want to start sticking needles around the eye.
Oh, no.
But what I would say is that for the areas, other areas on the head, and especially in the neck, if you can pinpoint when you press on the neck, if you can pinpoint where there is pain, mm-hmm. that's where I would do that test with the local anesthetic to see how well it alleviates that discomfort and whether you also establish better function again. If you take the pain away and you find, wow, I can move my head around a lot better, that tells us that the muscle has been giving you a big problem, and then there are other treatments to try and get that muscle back into shape.
Yeah, see, I've had 13 CAT scans over the 4 years for the cancer, mm-hmm. so that's why they thought it would be better for an MRI for less radiation.
Well, sure, that's reasonable, but
it would do just as good a job, would it?
Usually, the MRIs will tell you if they show you if there's tears in muscle, if there's damage in the brain. So yeah, they'll do a very good job.
Okay, so either one.
So I hope that helps, Lorna, but there's still some things that can be done, and I would speak to your family doctor about that as a means of trying to determine, you know, if there's other ways to help alleviate the pain and also to pinpoint exactly what the problem is.
That's wonderful. I've got this all written down.
Good. I'm glad.
Thank you ever so much.
You're very welcome. And we're going to take a small break, and Bernie, and we haven't forgotten about you, you are coming up next. We also have Marie, Anne, and Jackie in no particular order, also waiting on the line. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we will be right back after this break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Bernie.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good. Just I feel good. It's just my breathing's bad.
Yeah.
I had in 2009, a cardiologist told me I had to have a heart operation and replace the aortic valve because it was down to decimal 7 and the measurement's usually 2.
Right.
So I went in and had the operation. 7 days after the operation, I was in the Heart Institute in Ottawa here. I was feeling great. On the morning of the 8th, they took me out for an x-ray and the porter left me sitting in the hallway for a few minutes. After it, he wanted to see a man. I was sitting up in the stretcher, my feet dangling over when my sternum broke open. Blood came out of me like a hose. So I was 40. I passed out from the lack of blood, and I was out of the hospital 46 days later. Now, my breathing, if I exert myself at all, I'm puffing.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk slow. If I walk faster, I have to stop every once in a while to get my breath. I'm on a Symbicort turbohaler, red base, twice a day. I don't know if it helps me or not. My internist says my breathing problem is coming from my heart.
Right.
Yet my blood pressure and pressure is fine, and my pulse is around 50, and still I got a breathing problem.
Well, what you may have, Bernie, is you can have normal pressure and your heart rate can be okay, but it also has to go to, and I don't know if they've given you this information or have done the test, but to evaluate how well the heart actually functions. That is there are different ways to evaluate the heart. One of them is what we call an ejection fraction. That is how well the heart pumps blood out of the large ventricle, the left ventricle, which is the one that generates all the pressure. How much blood gets pumped out each time, and whether the heart can respond well when you make demands on it, when your body is starting to do something. So one of the things to find out is whether there's any measure of heart failure at all, because that would usually imply there's some mild heart failure. Whether the blood flow to the heart itself, whether there's any angina or whether the coronary arteries are blocked. These are some of the things that we need to find out with regards to the shortness of breath. This is what we call shortness of breath on exertion. And so normally what your heart will do is when you make demands on it, that is you start to walk or climb stairs or run, your heart rate picks up, blood flow increases, it pumps out blood more quickly, it's efficient at doing that, it delivers blood to the tissues, the blood contains oxygen, the oxygen is delivered to your muscles, and your muscles are able to function.
But it wouldn't be able to run.
Right. And so if your heart isn't able to deliver blood effectively enough, and this is, in a nutshell, what it boils down to, is that blood is not being delivered quickly enough to your body.
But all my arteries are good. I have no blockages. I've been checked.
There may not be blockages, but the heart itself, if your internist says that it's the heart that's doing this, it may mean that the heart, you can have great pipes and everything flows through, but if the pump is not pumping through those pipes very well, it's not pumping fluid through those pipes, or in this case, blood, if it's not able to pick up the pace when it's needed, then you everything down the line begins to suffer.
Can I get a new pump?
Oh, that's the major question. There are things that can assist the heart at pumping a bit better. There are medications that can sometimes improve that. But what I would suggest, Bernie, in order to get, because I'm only going by the history, in order to get an answer to explain the mechanism of why this is happening, ask your internist what the diagnosis is with regards to your heart. Ask if it is heart failure. Ask if it is a chamber in the heart that has become dilated or that is not able to pump blood through. And even ask what the what we call the ejection fraction, or EF, what that number is. Normally, anything above 40 is considered to be okay.
The EF.
EF, ejection fraction.
Nobody tells me anything.
Well, and this is why it's important, because obviously you want to know. You're calling up to find out why you're short of breath when you exert yourself.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, and you're rightly saying, you know, you're commenting that my arteries are okay, my valve is okay, so what's actually happened?
Yeah.
And so at least you'll have an answer as to why. They may not be able to fix it, but at least you'll have an answer.
Well, they said I couldn't have any more operations.
Right.
they made that mistake wiring up my sternum wrong.
Yeah.
And then an incisional hernia
appeared
about 3 months later. And I went to another surgeon out of the city. Even,
mm-hmm.
And he said it wasn't tied in properly when they started and it broke open. So I got a big bulge in my chest,
oh,
and they can't fix it because they won't touch me.
Well, at least, Bernie, ask him what the diagnosis is for the heart with regards to its function. Ask if there's heart failure. Ask if it's just been damaged because of the valve that originally was there and the heart just hasn't recovered even after the replacement. These are the things that you need to ask them, but just ask for a specific diagnosis. What is it that's going on with my heart that is now leading to shortness of breath when I try to move around and exert myself?
This has been going on since 2009, you know?
Yeah, and so it might be from the valve, because sometimes what happens if the valve was very narrow, right? It was the aortic valve.
Well, they told me, I asked about that valve once a few months ago, and they said, well, my echogram shows the valve is in place.
Right.
But maybe it's no good. Can a valve be replaced now through the arteries?
Well, it can, but it might not be the valve. What I'm suggesting is that because you had this before you had the surgery, and this valve was literally stiff, I would imagine, just the blood wasn't flowing through it very well, the heart had to work harder because it was trying to push blood through a narrow hole instead of through a wider hole.
Yeah, I had bad breathing then, and now I got bad breathing as I had before the operation.
And what happens is that the heart gets larger, as like any muscle would, if it has to work harder. But it can get too large, and what happens is that it then reaches a point of no return and begins to fail. And although they replace the valve, what you want to know is whether, when they did the ultrasounds of the heart, you want to know if the heart has responded favorably. That is, has the heart shrunk down to normal, or are there areas of the heart that have been damaged because of the valve problem you had and just have not recovered? Because that certainly would help answer your question.
I see. Well, they haven't told me any answers. You know, I get echograms, I get treatments, they use me well, but I'm not getting any results.
Yeah, you need to ask them and just say, look, I'm not leaving until you at least give me an answer. What is the diagnosis? This should not be difficult for them to tell you, because you're having shortness of breath. They've already said it's your heart. You can tell what's going on with the heart by doing these tests. You can tell how the heart is responding.
Right.
You can see the blood flow. You can see what's going on in the arteries. You can see what's going on with the valves. You can measure the pressures. You can measure how quickly the heart is beating. You can measure the thickness of the walls of the heart. You can measure the ejection fraction. There's all kinds of things that they can tell by doing that to be able to give you an answer why this is happening.
They should know all that right now.
They should. That's why, and that's why I'm saying they should be able to give you an answer. You know, they may be just saying it's your heart because it certainly sounds like it could be given your history, but they're being too general about it. And I think what you want is you want specifics.
I want an answer, because
I'm
not a young lad, and I've been in business all my life. I get something go wrong, I go fix it.
Yeah, and so I think you're certainly well within your rights to just say, look, tell me what is wrong with the heart. Fine. If you can't fix it, fine. At least I know what's going on and why I'm having the shortness of breath.
I appreciate that, doctor.
Oh, you're very welcome, Bernie.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Right.
Bye-bye now. And unfortunately, we have just about run out of time. And I wanted to get to you next with regards to the dropped foot, because this is an interesting phenomenon with regards to the nerves that could be possibly contributing to the dropped foot. So if you can give me a call next Sunday, call in early. I'll be able to answer your question. Same thing for Marie in Ottawa, who wanted to know about vertigo. But we really only have about 30 seconds left in the show. Thanks to everyone who's called. And those, again, I apologize to those who have been waiting quite some time. Thanks to Sebastian for producing another great episode of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You have been listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back again next week with another edition. Everyone, have a great week.